Cervantes o vamos ahí. Ecclesiastes, the book which is nobody's friend, well, almost nobody's. Perhaps it's the lecturing brother's friend from time to time when he wants a handy verse to prove that man is mortal. For when we are told man hath no preeminence above a beast, all go unto one place, all are of the dust, and all return to dust again. We could hardly want anything more expressive than that to show that man dies like the beasts. Though even perhaps the lecturing brother is not altogether satisfied. For there is always the embarrassment of that awkward verse, who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward? Or the spirit of the beast that returneth to the earth? Easy though it might be to get round to a convincing explanation of that if we try hard. But for the rest, none of us really likes to be told, repeatedly, verse after verse, chapter after chapter, with monotonous, later middle-aged insistence that vanity of vanity, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. It gets a little wearisome after a while. Like the writer of the book, it seems, if this is what he is really saying, we begin to wonder what it's all about. There might perhaps be those who would be better pleased than some others at learning that the advice of this writer, if it is his advice, is be not righteous overmuch, neither make thyself overmuch wise. For why shouldest thou destroy thyself? For that's an excellent piece of counsel for temporizing, for being fairly good but not very good, for going partway on the road to perfection and then saying at the end, God can't reasonably expect more, I'm only human after all. And supposing that at that point we may get away with our imperfections, that trying to be too righteous is even dangerous, if that is what the writer is really saying. But then there's that most distressing picture of old age given in the last chapter, where the almost caricatured image of the bent, bowed, toothless, hard of hearing old man reveals to us all too uncomfortably the kind of person we might one day be. No, it's not a comfortable book, not an easy book to accept, not when it comes to that which it is easy to, at first sight, see as reflecting the whole counsel of God in any case, one which only rather abruptly at the end leads us to hear the conclusion of the whole matter and see something we hadn't expected to see in a book which, read superficially, gives us almost no preparation for it. When God does come into the picture, he comes into it in two ways. One is that, and this part we might like, he is presented before us as the giver of many present good and perfect gifts. Well, good gifts, if not perfect. Such as plenty of food for those who have plenty, less for those who have too little. Plenty to drink for those who are well off, not enough for those who are poor. And one who authorizes, almost indeed expects and encourages, eat and drink, knowing that tomorrow we die. And if those particular words are not taken from the book of Ecclesiastes, but are taken from Paul's first letter to Timothy, well then again we have a contrast, apparently, between the teaching of this book and what we are later told. For if it is the case, that it certainly is, that on several occasions in the book of Ecclesiastes we are invited to eat and drink, and to enjoy the good of this life, because we don't know what will happen tomorrow. When the Apostle Paul comes to refer to that and says, eat and drink, for tomorrow we die, as certain people falsely assert that we preach, then it's quite plain that if the Apostle were referring to the book of Ecclesiastes, in terms which suggest that it's false to say that he said things like that, then the idea of eating and drinking and being merry for tomorrow we die is no part of the Apostle Paul's philosophy, whatever it was of the book of Ecclesiastes. And although those who are very young might find some pleasure in live joyfully with the wife of thy youth, or rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, it's a little uncomfortable to be told immediately afterwards, yet know that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. No, the book that is nobody's friend, at first. Nor will we perhaps feel very much more friendly disposed towards it at the early part of the conclusion of the early part of this talk. We shall have to see. Let's start seeing the first one. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. We run into problems with the very word preacher. It's a word that occurs 7 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. 3 times in the first chapter, 3 times in the 12th, and once in the 7th. And it doesn't occur anywhere else, all in Scripture. So we have a little problem as to what the word preacher means. Sometimes we get over the difficulty by taking out of the English language altogether and putting it back into the Hebrew and calling him Kohelet, which is the word which is so rendered. But then you ask, what does Kohelet mean? And, well, nobody seems to be quite sure. There's a verb, kahal, which seems to mean to call together or to assemble. There is a noun, kahal, which has the idea of an assembly having been called together. And there is at least one writer, one in our own midst, who regards it as being probable that the meaning of the caller together, or the gatherer together, is that the writer of this book was quite used to assembling lots of facts, or data, or proverbs. After all, he spoke, how many proverbs was it? 3,000? Anyway, a lot. As recorded for it in the first book of Kings. And so he would say rather the collector than the preacher. That doesn't seem, though, to be the most likely meaning of the word, for if one looks up in a concordance, as I lately have, all the occurrences of the word to assemble, or the assembly, well, it nearly always seems to be an assembly of people, usually the people of Israel, commonly caught together by a leader, quite often Moses. And in all these cases, called together either for a specific purpose of hearing words of wisdom or else doing tasks which are appropriate to a body of people seeing their duty and determined to do it. Sometimes the other way around, a body of people who didn't see their duty and come together for purposes which are unworthy of them and have to be rebuked by God when they get together. But certainly it would seem to me the overall weight of testimony is that Kohelet means one who convenes an assembly. Or one who, having got an assembly together, preaches to it. The word preacher isn't a bad word after all. It quite often happens when we seek to improve upon our translations of Scripture that we've driven back into the original words and say that will do very nicely. Certainly those who translated the Old Testament into Greek thought it was something like that, for the word which heads our book, Ecclesiastes, means one who is concerned with an ecclesia. And we are accustomed to speak of ourselves as an ecclesia, or as ecclesias, either the Church of God as a whole, or the Church of God in Canic, or Hull, or wherever it might be. And so it is in the Old Testament quite often used of the assembly of Israel. Stephen says, for example, that Moses was one who bore witness to the church that was in the wilderness, the ecclesia in the wilderness, and he means the congregation of Israel. So Ecclesiastes could very well be an addresser of a congregation. What is that but the preacher? The preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, son of David is not perhaps quite precise, for son in the scriptures is very commonly used, not merely of the immediate descendant of his line begotten, but of a grandson or a great grandson, or, well, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the son of David. The son of Abraham. And according to Matthew's record, that was at least 28 generations later. So, son of David could mean a long-term descendant of David, quite a long way off. It might, in other words, refer, as far as the words are concerned, to anybody from Solomon through Rehoboam and Abijah and Asa, and right down through the list, for I can't recite the names of the kings of Israel and Judah, until the reign of King Zedekiah. It could refer to any one of these, in principle, as far as it goes. King in Jerusalem could mean the same either. For of the king who reigned in Jerusalem, we start off with David himself, who in his reign spent his first 7.5 or 8 years in Hebron, and then the remainder in Jerusalem. And from that time onward, all the kings of David reigned in Jerusalem. Some of them were buried in the royal sepulchre in Jerusalem, they mostly were, though some of the wickedest of them had to be buried elsewhere, in one case at least, without the gates. But Jerusalem was their common reigning place, from David's 8th year and onwards, so that too could apply to a wide variety of people. None of these in themselves fixes the man as being Solomon. There are quite a lot of incidental things later in the book that do point that way, and of those, perhaps the most decisive, if we can just for a moment turn over to the 12th chapter, is that which tells us, as the message of the chapter is going to a close, in chapter 12, verse 9, that, "And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed, and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth." So if this writer is one who set in order many proverbs, then either he was the composer, the inventor, and the God spirit of the proverbs, which leads us at once to the book of Proverbs and to King Solomon, or else he was somebody who might have been the instrument of gathering proverbs together, which again leaves it just a little bit in the air, because we do learn in the book of Proverbs itself that some part of that book consists of the Proverbs of Solomon, which Hezekiah, or the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied out. So we haven't quite excluded other possibilities than Solomon himself at that point. One might think that verse 16 of our chapter, though, goes a long way towards deciding that it was Solomon. Because in this verse we read, "I communed with mine own heart, saying, Lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart hath had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I gave my heart to know wisdom, and to know madness and folly." And the emphasis on the word wisdom there, earlier in this chapter, continuously throughout the book, and in the last chapter as we have seen, is one which certainly seems to fit best that man who, having been the subject of a vision given to him by God in a dream of the night and invited to choose what gifts he would have, chose to have understanding that he might guide God's people rightly, and was granted it. Now that, which almost seems like a cast iron case for Solomon as the author of the book, does nevertheless have its objectives. For those who would say, what does this man mean by saying, "I am come to great wisdom, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem"? For they say there had only been one before him in Jerusalem, and all of one is still one, and hardly justifying a plural word. So why all they that have been before me in Jerusalem? Well, perhaps we're helped in that by something which is said about the wisdom of Solomon himself if we turn back to an early stage of his reign in the first book of Kings. 1 Kings, chapter 4. Which is, in fact, a very helpful passage altogether in putting the book of Ecclesiastes in perspective. 1 Kings, chapter 4, verse 29. "And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much, and largeness of heart even as the sand which is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country, and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men, than Etham the Eshrahite, and Heman, and Calcol, and Dada, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the nations round about, and he spake 3,000 proverbs, and his sons were 1,005, and he spake of priests from the seed of his in Lebanon, even unto the hyssop that springeth out of the wall. He spake also of beasts, and fowl, and creeping things, and of fishes. And there came all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all kings of the earth which heard of his wisdom." And although that perhaps doesn't take us very far in deciding how one generation can be made to sound like many, wiser than all they which had been before me in Jerusalem, the mention of people like Etham the Ezraite and Heman does take us a little further, because if you look carefully through the titles to the book of Psalms, you will find out that Etham the Ezraite does actually appear as one of the people concerned with one of the Psalms contained in that book. And so presumably he was one, perhaps, of a body of wise men whom David had gathered around him in Jerusalem. And Solomon was not necessarily saying, "I was wiser than all the kings that were before me, but I was wiser than all my predecessors in wisdom, some of whom lived in the reign of David my father, who gathered so many wise and ardent people around himself." Even that fact is not quite exhaustive, because in Jerusalem we do actually know the names of at least two other kings who had reigned there. I don't know whether you can remember them, but one of them is a man called Melchizedek, king of Salem, who had reigned quite a long time before and was certainly a very godly man, presumably a very wise one, who blessed Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings. And then, although there's very little to be said for his character, there was another man called Adonizedek, who was killed in the days of Joshua and was also king of Jerusalem, and suffered rather unpleasantly for the afflictions which he had imposed upon other people. But it does mean that there obviously had been a line of kings reigning in Jerusalem long before even David and Solomon took over. It seems, in fact, that the Jebusites, who occupied the citadel in the centre of Jerusalem until David and Joab and his men stormed them in the 8th year of David's reign, could well have included people of considerable prowess and heathen wisdom. So, yes, there's no real difficulty about seeing Solomon himself saying, "I was wiser than all that were before me in Jerusalem." It is pointed out in Knox's translation of Ecclesiastes 2, as he faces this difficulty, that there's a rather comparable passage in 1 Kings chapter 14, in the reign of Jeroboam the first of Israel, where Jeroboam is accused of having done evil more than all the kings that were before him. Since Jeroboam immediately succeeded David and Solomon in the northern kingdom, you're saying all are only two even then, unless in the case of Jeroboam too other people are being included in the reckoning. So I'm going to assume with quite a contented mind that Solomon was the one who was behind the composition of this book. So we go back again now to chapter 1, and we have the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. If the preacher does mean the one who addresses an assembly, perhaps the one who calls an assembly together, there's a rather attractive thought emerges. For in 1 Kings chapter 8, we have the record of what happens when Solomon dedicates the people to the Lord in the very early days of his reign and offers that striking prayer of his that takes something like 50 verses of the first book of Kings chapter 8 to the whole congregation gathered together, and then he turns and blesses them, as though that perhaps was Solomon fulfilling his preacher office. And whereas I don't know whether there is anything of the kind that happened towards the end of his reign, we do know that when Rehoboam was about to ascend the throne over all Israel were come to Jerusalem to make him king, and there might very well, if Rehoboam had followed his father's example, have been another assembly of the same kind at the beginning of Rehoboam's reign, which could perhaps have gone as prosperously forward as Solomon did at that stage. And one wonders just perhaps whether Solomon, reaching the end of his mortal life, might have done something of the kind that David did towards the end of his mortal life, and sought to prepare the road and make easy the path for his successor, and provide for an assembly of people who would hear wise words and would live appropriately in the strength of what they heard. It's a speculation only. But the preacher, the addresser of the congregation, seems to me to suggest that the message of this book might very well have been part of a public message before a large congregation of Israel, sometime, and I think there's good reason to think it would be sometime, towards the close of Solomon's life, when all his experiences, or nearly all of them, lay behind him. And now he starts off with his depressing rhythm, with his constant refrain, "Vanity of vanities," saith the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labour wherein he laboureth under the sun? One generation goeth and another generation cometh, and the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth and the sun goeth down and hasteth to his place where he ariseth. The wind goeth towards the south and turneth about unto the north. It turneth about continually in its course, and the wind returneth again according to its circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full unto the place whither the rivers go, thither they return again. All things are full of weariness. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear with hearing." Try to put that in perspective. We all have to do a rather difficult thing in talking to one another about general things. Every exhorting brother who ever exhorts, and every lecturing brother who ever lectures, and every Bible class speaker who ever speaks in a Bible class, and everyone who presumes to take upon himself the responsibility of talking about a difficult part of Scripture to an audience assembled on a Saturday night, has to do something of a rather surprising kind. He has to make himself, for the time being, somebody whose half out of this world altogether. He has to become an observer of the universe from outside, a reflector upon things going on which he is looking at as though he weren't involved in it. One who, for the time being, has become timeless, who isn't getting older as other people get older, who sees old age coming on, but for the time being has stopped his own clock and is going looking at the world almost, and this is the danger which has to be so terribly guarded against, as though in some limited way he were posing as God himself. Because he mustn't do that. But we all do something like this when we're looking at the world. When we pass judgment on the world, it's nearly all the world except me. When we pass judgment on the wickedness of mankind, it's nearly always mankind, the present speaker accepted. Sometimes in generous moments, the present company accepted. And when we are giving our judgment upon what the world is like, what man is like, what sin is like, what the wickedness of capitalism or socialism or communism or the big business magnates or whatever they might be are like, it's their me. And I stand outside and try to see the rest of the world. Now, in a sense, even an inspired preacher does that. He does it better than the rest of us because he isn't without the judgment of God to help him. Does it more convincingly if we have eyes to see and ears to hear, because the imperfections of our human counsels are smoothed out and purged by the wisdom of God which shines through the otherwise imperfect judgment of man. But Kohelet, the preacher here, is in a sense not one man but two. He is a man who throughout this book is engaged in doing many of the things which he is later to condemn. He's taking part in the things which he will criticize. And is, as it were, looking at not just the world apart from himself, from outside, but the world including himself from outside. He's both inside and outside, doing the things inside, and sitting back and taking a good look at himself, as being typical of other people. In the first few verses of this chapter, though, he is giving us a very general survey, from outside, of what all mankind and all its world and all the things going on in this world are like. And if we might allow him to seem to be saying, from another uninspired source, all the world's a stage, then this is what's going on the stage according to this chapter. First of all, the sun rises in the east. It climbs above the horizon and it gets to its zenith and it begins to fade towards the west and at sundown disappears beneath the horizon. It's gone. But something has been happening to it during the night. For next morning at round about the same time, there it is rising again in the place it came from. And again it goes to its zenith, and again it declines, and again it disappears, and it keeps on doing that, day after day, throughout the changing seasons, year after year, throughout life. The sun ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. And there you have the whole cycle. It doesn't just arise and go down, it goes back to where it started, hasteth to the place where it arose, and goes round and round. This is due from a human point of view upon the earth, in a very systematic, but it seems, a very futile way. What's it doing that for, day after day? You might see him asking. Why does this go on time after time? What's the purpose of it? It's very rhythmic and very systematic and very predictable. It's very monotonous and very boring. So he might seem to be saying. And not only that. There's the sun. What else have we got? We've got the wind. Now the wind is nothing like so systematic. You don't have the wind blowing from the east and blowing to the west and going round underneath and coming back and blowing that way. No, the wind hasn't got the same purposiveness about it. The wind goeth towards the south and turneth about unto the north. It turneth about continually in his course, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. You can't timetable the wind. But at least it always seems to be moving, sometimes faster, sometimes slower, sometimes a gentle zephyr, sometimes a tornado, but still it's blowing. And if the wind is trying to get anywhere, it never seems to arrive. It keeps on blowing. And in its own rather unsystematic way, what could be more unsatisfactory and purposeless than that? Looked at from the outside. And having dealt with light and wind, well, turn to water. All the rivers run into the sea. yet the sea is not full. Unto the place whither the rivers go, thither they return again. And those words, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full, almost sound like a rather complaining version of the problem set in school by arithmetic books, where two taps are entering water into a bath, while three boys A, B, and C, with leaky buckets, are carrying water to fill that bath, but unhappily they have not put the plug in. And moreover, water is leaking out of the bath, and all the buckets go into the bath, yet the bath is not full. This seems to be the kind of thing that the writer is complaining about. And whether it is or is not a ground for complaint, it's certainly a fact of life that rivers do flow into the sea. Rivulets flow into streams, and streams into rivers, and rivers into larger rivers, and those into tidal rivers, and they flow into the sea, and the sea never seems to get in it. Well, why? Why? Because the water evaporates again. And it ascends up invisibly into the clouds, and there the clouds are ready to pour rain upon the earth, and the rain falls, and it arrives upon the land, and it wets it, and it soaks in, and it, by one route or another, gets back into the rivulets and the streams and the rivers and the bigger rivers and the tidal rivers and the sea. And this goes on time and time again. They never succeed in filling the sea up. If they did, they might have achieved something, even if we all drowned in the process. But they'd have got somewhere, so the writer seems to be saying. And if it weren't that there's that cumulative futility, there's something worse. You've got the sun going like that, and you've got the winds going anyhow, and you've got the rain going like that, and up and down again. And you've got man. One generation coming, and another generation going. But the earth abideth forever. You've got the earth as the stage. And what happens? Why, at some portion of the stage, there crawls on all fours a howling child. And as it enters the stage, helpless, demanding and getting its food from its mother, it gradually grows bigger as it gets nearer the centre of the stage, and by the time it's halfway towards the middle, it's standing unsteadily upon its feet and tottering closer to the centre, and then walking, and then strutting, and then standing in the middle of the stage and saying, "Look at me, the pride of all creation, here I am, man." And it walks towards the other side of the stage with gradually greying hair, with gradually diminishing number of teeth, with gradually stooping gait of the kind which is to be so categorically described to us in the last chapter of the book. And just before it gets to the end of the stage, you can see it draw its last feeble breath, and it falls off into the wings dead. Meanwhile, another child has reached the centre of the stage and is now at the strutting stage. And another baby has just crawled off in the far distance. One generation cometh, and another generation goeth. That's a cycle too, isn't it? Infancy, youth, maturity, later life, old age, death, birth, youth, old age, death, birth, youth, old age, death. It isn't a cycle, it's nothing of the kind. It was the same sun that went from there and went round and came back. Not the sun's sun. It was the same wind that whirled about. The same water that went up and down. Not the same child. One generation cometh, and another generation goeth. The one child is done. If we are to accept the judgment which the later part of the book tells us more than once, has done its part. When man hath no preeminence of other beast, all go unto one place, all are of the dust, and all return to dust again. It isn't just that the sun goes round and round, and the wind goes to and fro, and the water goes down and up. It is that all the time this is going on, achieving nothing but at least going on, man isn't going on. He starts, and he stops with a terrible finality. One generation cometh, and another generation goeth. No wonder the writer, with those thoughts to present before us, tells us that if that were all there is to think about, and if that were the only conclusion we could come to, and if there was nothing more to life than that, then vanity of vanities, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Having got to that point, he then tells us in verse 12 his own program of investigation. Chapter 1, verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Another indication, by the way, that it was Solomon, because although it's not impossible after the days of Solomon to call the people he reigned over in Jerusalem Israel, they're more often called Judah. For the nation split up after the time of Solomon. Israel tended to become the name of the northern tribe, or of the people as a whole, after that. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. It is a sore travail that God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and is striving after wisdom. So from that point on, Solomon engages in considering a variety of phenomena which he sees, and in which he in some measure participates, and seeing to what conclusions they lead. Remember, he is standing from outside and watching the world, standing from outside and watching his alter ego, looking at himself as he frolics on the world stage, looking at himself as he builds in great works, looking at himself as he engages in the pleasures that life offers, and looking at himself as he grows older, and passing judgment upon himself, as he invites us all to remember that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. And so, that which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. A wide-flung survey, no doubt, over all the course of history, from the time when crookedness first made itself felt in a crooked world, and our variety of crooked men built their crooked houses, used their crooked sixpences, crawled over crooked stiles, and did all the crooked things that men do do. And he says, try though you may, you can't put it straight. Know all the things which are lacking in human life, and you can't fill them up. This, he says, is a frustrating world. Of course, we might, for our own point, you just lighten the picture a little at that point, because we later hear, not so very much later either in the scriptures, something quite different, where there is the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make straight in the deserts a highway for our God, every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill made low, the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough place is plain, and all the world shall see the salvation of our God. And what you can't see with the eyes of Koheleth, as he looks at the world with a human gaze, though he's divinely inspired to put down his observations, you can see in promise when Isaiah speaks of the forerunner of the Christ, and can see at least in partial realization as that Christ comes, takes the book, opens it up and says, this day is this scripture fulfilled in your ears, of the words, the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because he hath appointed me to preach good tidings to the poor, and the opening of the prisons to them that are bound. For the time being, though, the preacher is not prepared to make that kind of statement to us. He is showing us life in the law. I commune then, verse 16, with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all that have been before me in Jerusalem, and the other things which describe the extent of the wisdom of God given to him. This presents us with a problem about Solomon. When we call him the wise man, we do so in the light of that promise that God made to him in the dream when he sought for understanding rather than riches. We have a justification for doing so. When we call him the wise man, we recall perhaps that people came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, including the Queen of Sheba, who did so. And we have the Lord's commendation of the wisdom of Solomon as being one who justified such a visit, though he puts it in perspective by telling us that a greater than Solomon is here, and those who come from the ends of the earth to render glory to our God, as he has revealed in his Son Jesus Christ, are doing a far, far better thing than she did who came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. But still, we have ample warrant for describing him as a wise man. And 3,000 proverbs, of which the book of Proverbs preserves a few, are no small testimony, in addition to the many songs he wrote, including the best of them all, called the Song of Songs, shows how wise, how gifted this man was. But When you look at the life of Solomon as described in the book of Kings, the first book of Kings, and repeated elsewhere, the wisdom is not really very supreme above the other characteristics of his life. He was very prosperous. He was very rich. He wrought great works, spending 7 years in building the house of God. Wrote great works of a very secular kind, spending 13 years in building his own house. We see the lack of a sense of proportion. Wrought great works in building a house for, whatever they did in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Wrought great works in building another house for Pharaoh's daughter, who was the daughter of an Egyptian, presumably heathen king. How many other houses he built for how many others of his wives, I do not know, but the multiplying of his wives to himself led him into such a state that, looking back upon the experience he had with that enormous seraglio, he had to say, a man I may find, but a woman amongst a thousand. No. And this man Solomon is one of whom it is said his many wives turned away his heart. And he built houses for the worship of false gods. And his iniquity was so great that even during the later years of his own reign, God raised up enemies to him. And before he died, the knowledge had been propagated that for the sake of the life he had lived, 10 tribes would be forfeited in the reign of his son, and the nation would be divided into two. Wrought great works. But at such a cost that it would seem with some excuse, when the people came to present themselves before his successor, King Rehoboam, they said, thy father made our yoke heavy, now ease thou the burden that is laid upon us. And from the picture given us, the chariot cities and the store cities and the buildings and the taskmasters over forces and what God did by way of forced labour with the heathen to settle in the land, there appears to be considerable evidence that although Israel at the end of Solomon's reign was superficially at least very rich and prosperous, beneath that there fostered a deep discontent, which meant that Solomon's wisdom was certainly not all there was to say about it. Unlike the Lord Jesus Christ, whose wisdom was justified in her children, whose wisdom was unsullied by any corresponding follies, whose righteousness unspoiled by any compensating vices, of whom it can never be said, as Ecclesiastes had to be said, that the dead flies in the ointment of the apothecary sent forth a stinking savour. There were plenty of follies to darken the reputation of Solomon, none to darken the reputation of the Lord. Wisdom is a strange thing. You can have it and not have it at the same time. It can be yours and you can be deprived of it at one and the same time. You can stand outside it and see it. You can be within it and misuse it. And this is what Solomon was like. Wise and not wise, one and the same time. I think in a way we get this in our own lives too. There's many an exhorting brother who only seems to be a good exhorting brother, insofar as any of us is a good exhorting brother, when he is talking to an audience of comparative strangers, who seems less so in the eyes of his own wife, shall we say. Perhaps even more does he seem less so, if that makes sense, in the eyes of his own children. And it would seem less so in everybody's eyes if they could take a peek through the walls of his house into his everyday life in the company of his wife and children, who is in fact two quite different people, living in the world in his own home on Mondays to Saturdays and talking about the world on Sundays, who can propound very great wisdom to other people, which they do well to follow, and yet who shows in his own private life, if you could see it, that the wisdom doesn't have as much effect upon himself as it ought to. If you guessed I was talking about the life of knowledge, you were right. But not about him alone. It applies to a lot of people. And I suppose this is really what we mean by Solomon being wise and not being wise. The wisdom to discern was there. He could do wonderful things when somebody else's baby was brought before him and some false claimant said it was hers. He knew exactly how to deal with that situation. Perhaps he knew how to deal with the other situations too. But when they came right home, the temptations, the politics, the lusts, all the other things that moved him in other ways, made him forget the necessary things at the urgent moment of decision. And his wisdom didn't exactly forsake him, but it didn't concern him. That was for other people's benefit. This is a very real thing, actually, in our own lives. Something we need constantly to be warned against. This, making ourselves the great exception to the application of our wisdom. But we all do it to some extent. We all live a double kind of life. Talking right things to others, not being quite so right when it comes to the way we live. The extremes of it, of course, are Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But the possibility is there with us all. So it was with Father. I had experience of wisdom, and I applied my heart to know wisdom, and to know from inside you, my dad, to know madness and folly. My wisdom remaining within me, he says. So now, he sets about his task. And although we can't give all the other examples, what I've tried to do is to summarise a number of the cases which the writer deals with as he goes throughout the early part of the rest of this book, facing a series of problems that convince him that the world is a strange place, and which, considered only on the level which he is at present considering it, can only be judged the seat of vanity of vanities, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So, he says, take first the case of mirth and pleasure, chapter 2, verse 1. I tried this, he says, and it didn't do any good. I said of laughter, it is madness, and of mirth, what does it? The mere cracking of jokes, the mere engaging in bonhomie with one's fellows, the mere loud laughter of those who gather together for enjoyment, as it is called, which sounds so deathless, those who hear it through a thin wall from one house to another. These things were things that Solomon tried and found vain, empty, fleeting, and at the end leaving you only with a rather considerable sense of guilt and nothing achieved, and wondering why you bothered and what there really was to laugh at. And if that didn't work, then he tried the more sensual things, the things with the more permanent drugging to the realities of life. And so I searched in mine heart how to cheer my flesh with wine, he says, mine heart yet guiding me with wisdom. And there you see what he is doing. He is, in a sense, a man not fully in his cups, but half in his cups, enjoying the sensation that quite a lot, if not actually too much, wine is giving him, and at the same time able to stand outside himself and observe the symptoms of semi or quarter intoxication, knowing the course of events, finding it quite pleasurable in itself, and yet able to look even this day upon tomorrow's probable hangover, and see that it's not achieving what he had hoped that it would achieve. He laid hold on folly, see what was good for the sons of men, what they should do under heaven all the days of their life, and the mere court jesters, though they might beguile him for a moment, left him again at the end of the day with a sense of days wasted, hours spent in useless pursuits, and again that vague sense of uneasy guilt that comes so often to the rest of us when we allow ourselves to be guided or misguided for an hour or two by the laughter-making pursuits of those whom we hear in voices through loudspeakers, or see in face and hear simultaneously with voices on screen. This sense of what was it all about, was it worth it, that so often adds to the ache in the human heart when we've allowed ourselves to do it. Of course, he went better than that. Verse 4. I made me great works. We've referred to them. The temple, his own house, the house of the forest of Lebanon, the house of Pharaoh's daughter, the store cities and the rest, the stables for his horses. Yes, the stables for his horses, and the houses for his wives. Both great works, and yet both flat contraventions of a law given long ago in the 17th chapter of Deuteronomy, where it was said most distinctly, though in the comparison of the two together seems slightly less fitting than we would like, that he shall not multiply horses to himself, and neither shall he multiply wives to himself. Yet Solomon did both, and built stables for the one and houses for the other. Great they were, but obviously not great in the right sense, and not satisfactory either. I made me great works, I builded me houses, I planted me vineyards, I made me gardens and parks, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruit. I made me pools of water, to water therefrom the forest where trees were reared, as the Revised Version puts it. A very capable man, a very enterprising man. One who was so far from being merely frivolous in the things he enjoyed that he built things to last, and if he disafforested a neighbourhood by having its trees cut down, it seems, he was prepared to reafforest it by having new trees reared up and built the reservoir to supply the water that caused the trees to prosper and not wither, and so provide for trees for a later generation, somewhat after the principle that the Lord Moses had already laid down for Israel conquering its land. A far-sighted man, doing very worthwhile things, and yet raising the question, worthwhile for who, for what, and for how long? I gathered me also, he said, I'm sorry, verse 7, I bought men servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possession of herds and flocks, above all that were before me in Jerusalem. And here the lustfulness of the man just begins to find its first hint. For having men servants is having men to work. Having maid servants can mean many other things. Having servants born in my house can raise, as it so often did in the lives of the lustful of Israel's kings, to whom they were born and by whom they were fathered. And I had great possessions of herds and flocks, above all that were before me in Jerusalem. And the provision made for the store cities and the flocks, the number of beasts that were slaughtered each day to provide the food in Solomon's temple, which is set out for us again in 1 Kings chapter 4. All these things are briefly echoed in this chapter as Solomon summarizes the great things that marked the outward prosperity of his days. I gathered me also silver and gold. He did indeed. He had a fleet of ships to bring them. They went and they brought gold and silver and ivory and apes and peacocks. Ships of Tarshish that brought these things back. So many of them that when they counted the amount of gold that came to Solomon in one year, they found it came to that forbidding figure of 666 talents of gold, providing perhaps some kind of background for the use of that same figure later in the book of Revelation. Yes, the wealth of the world came to Solomon's feet. So great was it that gold was abundant, silver was a common metal, and anything less than that was nothing accounted of in the days of Solomon. So we are told. We are not surprised to find that, in addition to those things of an immaterial kind, the fullness of Solomon's enjoyment and savouring of the things of this life comes out in, I got me men singers and women singers. And the delights of the sons of men, which in the revised version are nothing like musical instruments and that of all sorts, but are concubines, very many. Even if the verse didn't say that, and it seems to be generally agreed that it probably does, but it's certainly the fact of the case. And the 1,000 of wives and the 300 of concubines, described as being the consorts of Solomon, whether some of them were there merely to delight his eyes and some were there merely to cement political pacts, makes it quite plain that Solomon didn't stint himself in the enjoyment of the things of the flesh. Whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy. Everything without restraint, without restriction, no holds barred. For my heart rejoiced because of all my labour. And my wisdom remained with me. The same repetition of the perplexing theme. My wisdom remained with me. It can only be in the sense I've been speaking of, I think, that he had the coolness of mental approach, guided by God to understand, that let him see, even while it was going on, what it was that he was doing. Looking at it from the outside, seeing how empty and how vain it was, and ultimately coming to see to what conclusion, if left unreformed, it could only lead. Verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labour that I had laboured to do, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. In those verses we have dealt in fact not with one problem but with two. The problem of mirth and pleasure in the first three verses, the problem of the various attributes of material greatness and self-indulgence in the verses that follow. In the rest of this chapter we have two more with which we will conclude. First, the problem of wisdom itself and what use it is. Verse 12. And I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do that cometh after the king, even that which hath been already done? Then I saw that wisdom excelleth folly as far as light excelleth darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, and the fool walketh in darkness. And yet I perceive that one event happeneth to them all. There's no doubt that that which is right is better than that which is wrong, he says. There's no doubt that that which is true is better than that which is false. There's no doubt that that which is reasonable is better than that which is unreasonable. There's no doubt about that everything that belongs to a correct assessment of things and the appraisement of it at its true value is far better than giving oneself over to nonsense and jargon and mere pleasure and jesting. Yes, wisdom exceedeth folly in the same way as light exceedeth darkness. But he says, if it does, then in our familiar cliche, so what? And the answer to so what is, one event happeneth to them all. A wise man might live his 80 years and 10 or more or less, and so might a fool. And the end of it, what have you got? You have a dead sage and a dead fool. While they were alive, there was an enormous difference. Now that they're dead, what is there to choose between them? He is later to tell us that a living dog is better than a dead lion. It can hardly be said that so far as anything that concerns their own person, that a living sage after a dead sage is any better than a dead fool. They're both dead, he said. Then said I in mine heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so will it happen even to me. Why was I then more wise? What's the good of being wiser? And I said, this also is vanity. Not merely when they're dead will it all be the same to them. Very soon, he says, it will all be the same to everybody else. For, verse 16, for there is no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever. Seeing that that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dies the wise man? Even as the fool. Therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all its vanity and vexation of spirit. And you can say, he says, the highest sounding words you like about the immortal achievements of poets and historians and architects and builders and kings and warriors and all the wise men that ever there were. You can say the noblest things you like about them, but it means nothing else to them when they're gone, and it means very little else to later generations. There is no remembrance, he says, of former things. As the archaeologist finding for us the altogether forgotten wisdom of wise people of millions of thousands of years ago have been able to show to us when we thought we were the only wise people there had ever been. And in this chapter now we have in verse 18 what I have called the problem of survival and inheritance. He hated his labour because you can't take it with you, as I said. And that in itself is bad enough, but to live knowing that when you die, not only can't you take it, but you don't know who'll get it. That is a constant torment in life. Who knows, verse 19, whether he will be a wise man or a fool, yet he will have rule over all my labour. And so throughout the remainder of this section of the chapter, he goes on to speak of the torment that afflicts a conscientious heart when, knowing that he has done what he can, whether it's worth it or not, for the benefit of his own family, it might be, or his own tribe, or his own race, or even the whole world, there's no guarantee that it won't all be squandered when he dies. As in fact, of course, it was in Solomon's case, or very nearly all of it, when Rehoboam was foolish and Jeroboam was avaricious. And the kingdom was split in two, and before many generations had gone, they had both gone into captivity. And so he comes to the first of his commendations of secular enjoyment while you can, in verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and make his soul enjoy good in his labour. This also I saw, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who can have enjoyment more than I? For it is the man, for to the man that pleaseth him, God giveth wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he giveth travail, to gather and to heap up, that he may give to him that pleaseth God. This also, no doubt from the sinner's point of view, is vanity and the striving after wind. Ah, yes, but there is a fresh wind blowing through those verses. We have gone a little higher up the plane of achievement than we were before. The writer isn't just telling us that in despair you might as well have a good time. If that were his final answer, it would stand in flat contradiction to the teaching of Paul, who objected very much that anybody should say that was his teaching. Let us eat, drink, and be merry. He is saying, though, that no matter how short life is, no matter how you lose things when they're gone, if you do, no matter who gets them afterwards, wise or foolish, yet, bringing into the picture something he has never denied but is now positively asserting, there being a God who knows what he is about, if you never understand any more of his purpose than this, that he's going to tell us a lot more. If you never understand any more of his purpose than this, yet there is the food, God's given it. There is the drink, God's provided it. You've been very much blessed by God, at least to this extent for now, for as long as it lasts. And so, he says, enjoy it. While you can. I'm giving thanks for it, too. It almost sounds, doesn't it, as I take the leaf out of the president's notebook. For at this point, if there be perhaps something better, at least this is the immediate item in the agenda, that we should eat and drink and make our soul enjoy good. For this is from the hand of God.